outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Journey.
You have got to put a major disclaimer on the My Friend Lewis episode that came out this week. I know you had this great great disclaimer about listen at your own risk, that it might have to do with suicide and that there's trauma involved and death involved, but you didn't mention the fact that you were going to leave the audience with one of the worst cliffhangers on the face of the planet.
Worst? How do you mean worst?
By worst, I mean I have to go 7 days. 7 days.
You have to go 9 because you listened early.
That's true. Yeah, I'm being tortured even more because I have to wait even longer.
It was just a quote from Lewis. That's all it was.
No, it was not just a quote.
It was just a quote. That's the whole idea of a cliffhanger is people, somebody going, oh my gosh, when's the next one going to air and I'm not going to make it till it gets here, right?
Yes, and you definitely succeeded in that.
That's good.
I have not been this disrupted and out of sorts about a cliffhanger since Infinity War with Marvel, where I suffered through 2 hours of everybody dying, and they said, oh, by the way, you're going to have to wait 1.5 years, and then we'll let you know what happens.
Well, fortunately, then, this is only a week, so that's good.
True. That is true.
And secondly, I never saw Infinity War, so I never had a cliffhanger from them. I've had them on other shows, though, or at least that's over the summer. They drop you somewhere right in the end of the season and make you wait till the start of the next, but we've been warning people this is coming. I can't wait to finally share it. Yeah, I know some people have said, why are you doing these last 3 1 week at a time? And the answer is because that's when they're getting prepared. This one, the last one isn't ready yet. So it's not like I can put it up early. I guess we could have waited till now and put all 3 of them up on the same day. But no, I think I like people pondering things, holding it in their heart a while, not just rushing. I think when you binge something, you miss something. You don't let the individual moments find a place in your soul. But I know once they're all up, then everybody who's listening to My Friend Lewis now binge listens, man. Just
this one needs to be held. So I was driving home when I was listening to it, and I got my daughter in the car. She's napping, and thank goodness she was napping because I had to take several more laps around the block, and then I just sat in the car and just thought about it because I was very, very, very angry with Lewis's family. I could not believe the response that they made. And then it took days later for the captain to even check in on his injuries. The fact that he couldn't talk.
Like, let's not give up any more of it. Come on.
Okay. I won't go into too much detail, but oh my gosh. Like,
and there's some concern, obviously, is how the family is going to respond to this thing. Because it's...
Correct.
It is true. It is true what happened, but it is... They're all listening to the podcast, so...
Wow.
If they listened last week, that's the first time they would have known about what happened that night in the mountain because they've never heard that story. And then if they listen now they're going to realize, man, their reactions were completely inconsistent with what was really going on, which, you know what? That's a parable of life right there. How many times do we assume we know what's going on here and react accordingly, then find out later, man, what we thought was going on wasn't going on at all?
Yeah.
Hopefully there's the humility to own it, and because healing comes pretty quick when you can own stuff like that and seek forgiveness. And it's amazing to me that Lewis doesn't hold in his heart negative things about his family.
So they've never had the conversation since the passing of his father, and because it's been how long? 10 years? 15 years?
35.
Whoa, okay. Even way longer than I thought had in my head.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, so they didn't want to know. If it comes up, that's what they walk out of the room saying, I don't want to know. It's just people that don't want to process because it's too painful. And they're mostly responding to what happened that night, not what happened to Lewis. So it's fun to have those out there. It'll be really fun next week to have that one out. And then I'm going on vacation. So
so you're ditching all the emails and all the responses that you're going to get. You're going MIA.
I never ditch an email. It may take me a while to get back to people. But yeah, Sarah and I are taking a couple of weeks up in the mountains. So
nice.
That'll be kind of fun. Hey, I read something this morning I thought I'd run by you. This is Wayne Jacobson, by the way.
And this is Kyle Rice.
And you're at the God Journey, whether you intended to be here or not. That's where you are. I read this morning. I must have read this. It's one of my favorite books of all time in the Bible. I've read it often, probably yearly, throughout the last 50-some-odd years. Mm-hmm. Reading this morning, Hebrews 10, where it talks about the sacrifices offered year by year could never take away, could never make perfect those who draw near. It couldn't take away our consciousness of sin. He said otherwise they would have ceased to have been offered. If it could work, it would have worked. But it wasn't a real thing. It was a shadow thing.
Yeah.
And then he says, but in those sacrifices, there is reminder of sins year by year, which he's talking about the holy day when the priest goes into the Holy of Holies with the sins of the people. Okay, his reminder of sins year by year, for it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. And when I read that this morning, I went, man, the Jews had a reminder year by year of their failure and sins. How did Christianity get to a reminder week by week? Especially if you believe in the mass reasserting the sacrifice of Christ, especially if you go to a conservative evangelical Protestant fellowship that got to bash people over the head with their sins all the time and try and get them to do better. I mean, the one thing Jesus says the cross did was for all time, forever, take away our consciousness of sin. And yet, what did Dallas Willard call our religious institutions? He called it sin management systems. It was to remind people, you're not doing well enough, you need to try harder, as if the sacrifice of Christ had never happened.
Well, and almost worse, weekly sacrifices.
Yes, of attendance, of money, of time, of whatever. And it's all around sin, and I'm still struggling with this need in my life, and this appetite, and this desire, and I'm not doing bad. And it's just that reminder, reminder, reminder. And just reading Hebrews 10, the first time, all of that just made far less sense to me than it's ever made before. Why do we gather focused on our sin and failings and trying to do better for God if, in fact, the sacrifice of Christ worked, and we lose our consciousness of sin? And now as the passage goes on, we get to live inside of what it means to do the will of God, what it means to listen to God and follow God every day, rather than, I'm going to try and be better about myself. I'm going to try and stop this. I'm going to try and do better. It's as if it didn't happen. Someone wrote me a letter, email last week. They were talking about they've spent all their life trying to appease God. Well, even if you have an appeasement-based view of the cross, I've noticed this. I don't. I have an affection-based view of the cross. If you have an appeasement, Jesus appeased the Father in everything he would ever require of us. Jesus did that. That's the predominant view in Christendom. Even if you believe that, why are you still then appeasing God every day of your life? Why are you still doing that? Why do people who believe that the most work the hardest to keep God on their side?
I think largely because people feel like there's some sense of control there, right? When you're windblown, when you're walking windblown by the Spirit, it's a relational experience. You don't know what's going to happen in the day, but it's a joy of discovery. But there's no control over it. It's not the five easy step plan. It's hard to monetize. There's no ability to be manipulated and controlled by human effort if you're walking in that affection and just the joy of discovery with the Spirit. Now, if you have this need to appease and you're recognizing all these sins and you've got the attendance that you have to do and you have your whole checklist of what it takes to be a good Christian and how to manage your sin properly, well, at least I've got my list, right? Instead of, well, how do I learn how to even interact with this thing that we call Father or this personhood of the Holy Spirit? How do I even learn how to interact with that?
Especially if I can't, if I'm still struggling with sin in my life.
Absolutely.
I've got to earn this relationship with the Holy Spirit so that he will lead and guide me. But I struggle too much here, and I'm tempted too much there, and I fall into this, and I fall into that. And that's what keeps the Church of Jesus Christ in the world impotent in terms of the windblown life of the kingdom. God wants us not to wake up today trying not to sin, but to wake up today knowing that I'm loved, even where I still struggle and fail. And learn to get my heart focused on what is God giving me today and how do I live in that, rather than how do I stop doing things so God will be good to me. And yet most Christians live in the got to stop doing something for God to be good to me, or start doing something. I got to start reading my Bible every day. Yeah. I got to start doing this. I got to start doing that. It's all the do's and don'ts still dominate the attention of most people who aren't on what you and I would describe as a God journey. I mean, a God journey is different. It's not waking up aware of my sins and trying to do better today. It's waking up aware that I'm loved by God. And now, God, how would you lead me today? What are you giving me today? What are you setting me free from today that I need to be set free from? Because I can't do it on my own. So I'm not even trying to do it on my own. Because the rest of the chapter goes on saying, you know, the new covenant is this. Here I am to do your will, O God. And the will of God is not do these things and don't do those things. The will of God is, how is he moving me today? What is he inviting me? What is he showing me? How do I lean into that space and follow him today? And he knows how to walk us out of every place that we've got stuck in. He knows how to do that. We don't.
But you started at a starting point that I wonder how many believers or how many Christ followers today would start their day knowing that they're loved by God, that that's where they start in their day. What would you say, just in your mind, in the conversations you have, what would you say that the general population or the general percentage of people who claim to be Christ followers start their day that way?
I would hate to try and put a percentage on that. People I'm with a lot.
Yeah.
We can talk about the fact that I'm still struggling here. God has not fixed this in my heart yet, so I still struggle there. But I'm still learning to follow in spite of all that. I may have fear dominating my heart, but I talk about the fear. You could say, yeah, man, I have to tell you, I know there's this fear here, or I'm embarrassed in this, or I have shame or whatever. But me and Jesus are talking about it, not I'm trying to fix it on my own.
Correct.
I think those people, yeah, I think maybe, I'd hate to guess, but 10% maybe live inside the love of the Father. And that's what it means to me. It's the love of the Father that frees you to follow. It's not just, I believe in the love gospel and everything's been done in Christ and I don't have to do anything today. I kind of cringe a little bit when I hear some of that, because you were set free in the love of God to live to him today, to live inside of him today, to let him walk you through whatever he wants to walk you through to bring good things in your life and to teach how to navigate that really horrible space that you're trapped in because of the behavior of other people or whatever. And people, so many people miss that because they're looking for answers in a Bible, in a sermon. They're looking for little fix-it strategies to be better for God instead of, I want to walk with God so that he actually walks me out of the places where I'm afraid or tempted or broken or struggling. And I tell you, Hebrews just underscores that. Just reading through Hebrews again, which I do about once a year. I just love that. It's about coming to God with confidence, not because you're perfect, not because you got it all down, not because you do everything right. It has nothing to do with it. It's confidence in the work of Christ who's made God accessible to me in my brokenness so that he can walk me into wholeness. And that walking me into wholeness is a lifetime adventure. There's no hurry to it. There's no performance factors in it. It's just simply learning, like we talked about last week, to know and to follow.
I'm going to take us on a bit of a tangent here, but it ties in, I think.
Okay.
Have you ever felt like you have ever been in a space where you're prostituting your heart?
Prostituting my heart?
Or prostituting your passion?
Oh my gosh.
And I could unpack that a little bit more if you need me to.
Prostituting one of my children, perhaps. And I don't mean my physical children, my son or my daughter. I meant this little. I remember when Brad and I flew to New York to talk to some publishers about distributing the Shack for us. And it did, you know, we're being wined and dined because whatever publishing company takes us in, they're going to make millions of dollars off of distributing the Shack. I have this thing about publishers anyway, that's, you know, it's not truth is at the primary heart of what they're doing. It's monetizing. It's making money.
Yeah.
So Brad and I even joked about it. We joked about it on the flight out. We joked about it when we were there. Don't you feel like you're carrying your daughter off to New York and they're trying to tart her all up just like they do to American Idol contestants or any pop singer person, you know, they got this genuine gift, heart, whatever, and you want to pimp it up to make it more attractive in the world. And oftentimes that means literally sexing it up. Oftentimes it means that for particularly women, guys too, to some degree. But I guess I have. I don't know that I've prostituted my own heart. I mean, I think that the dangers of monetizing something you love risks that.
Yeah.
Particularly if you're going to look to monetize it to the maximum. That's what I see happen a lot in the world. And I won't say that there weren't moments in my journey of being a writer and putting books in the world and then having a website that there aren't moments when you get tempted that direction and made some choices that you had to walk back because this was different than what I got in it for.
So how did you walk it back? The reason why I asked that question is I've had two lines of conversation with young adults over the last couple of months that this conversation is really, or that question has really been highlighted. One is with people who have a really unique skill set and they just love doing it in their downtime. They're not doing it as their main career. They're not doing it as their primary vocation, but they're doing something in their side time that they absolutely love. And there's the opportunity to move into full time, or there's the opportunity to actually start making some substantial money off of it. And yet there's this real genuine question on their heart of, am I going to lose my love for it? Is it no longer going to be have the appeal? Am I going to lose the creativity? Am I going to lose what makes this a gift to me to begin with if I start making it my vocation? So that's one line of thought. The other line of thought that that's been really interesting is there's this concept in psychology about oversharing too much in order to gain affirmation and acceptance. That people share a real intimate part of their heart or a really precious part of who they are with somebody that they meet in a very short period of time with the hopes of it gaining emotional capital with that person to where they will have a more intimate relationship or a more impactful relationship. And I know you share a lot of who you are with people. You're willing to share a lot of your part, or like parts of who you are with people as they're navigating their journey. And we talked a little bit about this during the conversation about marriage and relationship a couple of weeks ago. You mentioned that there are things that are just for you or just for Sarah, but how do you protect those things? How do you find that space? Because I've been coaching some young people on how do you preserve some things just for you? How do you not give away the moment you have a beautiful or passionate or very personable experience? How do you not just instantly give it away, especially in our Instagram culture, because you feel like you need to share it? I know that was a lot.
Yeah, two different questions there, obviously.
They're very two different questions.
Yeah, let's do the first one first. When you talk about making something you're passionate about your vocation, and I think we've all had friends I've seen do that, whether it's getting in the ministry and then, you know, what you need to do financially for an institution to survive diminishes you as an individual because the motives get twisted. But I've known golf pros I've got a good friend who's a golf pro, never plays. You know, if he's a day off, he doesn't go anywhere near a golf course because that's where he works. I remember when I was pastoring, I was that way. I go on vacation, I would hardly read the Bible. It's like,
yeah,
I need a break from all that because that was like my job. And I needed a break from my job, which was unfortunate in terms of my own spiritual passion. So I think in that sense, it just became so overwhelming. Even people, you know, the phone calls, I hated when the phone rang because it was like, oh, crud, something's going to happen. Something's going to need me to do something. And usually with somebody I didn't know.
Yeah.
Now when my phone rings, it's exciting. And if somebody needs me, it's somebody I know and love and yeah, happy to help. So I think that happens fairly easily because people don't realize whether you're a, you know, singer songwriter or you're a writer or you're a pastor or golf instructor, tennis pro. I don't know what it would be. Somewhere when it becomes a job, there's so much more to a job than the one thing you may like to do. You may like to play golf, which is very different than standing on a driving range for 9 hours a day helping other people learn to play golf. You may really love preaching on a Sunday morning. A lot of people do. I love standing up and doing the pulpit thing. But they don't realize what it takes during the week to even create the environment for that to happen. Many people look at my life, traveling, writing, oh, it'd be a great life. Well, you don't have any idea what goes on behind the scenes, just website maintenance and issues and people and needs from Kenya. And you just have no idea what my life looks like. People see the outward stuff and go, that's really spectacular.
Yeah.
But the inside stuff can be painful. I would quit if I lost my passion. I think I would. I wouldn't do this as a job. Let me say that. Got to be better jobs. But I think a younger Wayne would have.
Really?
Wouldn't? Yeah. I think a younger Wayne would have just, okay, I'm stuck doing this, so I got to just make the best of it. I hear that from a lot of pastors who read some of my material, love it, but say, you know, I'd love to live like you do, but I can't figure out how to do that and make a living, so I'm just going to make the best of a bad situation. I've heard that a lot. And I think I probably hung in longer where I was at times because I felt a responsibility and a calling. I'm doing air quotes here, yeah, because I wouldn't say that in the same way. But yeah, where you just, when the passion of your heart becomes an obligation and a work, it will exhaust you. It will burn you out.
So what have been some things that you've done, whether intentionally or not intentionally, to protect that, to where it doesn't, you don't lose that passion, or that you continue to foster the joy of discovery or the joy of doing what you do?
I don't feel like I do anything intentional, which is, I know, not a great answer. I think where we got to earlier, where the journey for me is about waking up every day and saying, God, what do you have for me today? Mm. And when God's in it, I'm a very inspirational guy. I don't usually go, okay, I got to finish this book. I hate this book, but I got to finish it, whatever. I don't. I wake up, and where I'm inspired to write, I write or engage or whatever. And what's helped me a lot, I think as a pastor, one of the things that wore me out back in the day was how much time I had to spend with people who were complacent, who weren't hungry. And I was having to stimulate that hunger.
Yeah.
Jesus kind of warned the boys, when you go into a town and you proclaim your peace, if your peace returns to you, shake the dust off your feet and move on. Don't exhaust yourself with people who really aren't on a journey. The joy of the last 25 years for me is I don't spend a lot of time or attention propping up unhungry people.
Mm.
I don't. I just don't. I don't have friendships like that unless I feel like God's asked me to walk alongside somebody that may need to see the example of my life. Then yeah. I do have some friendships like that, where I don't think they're anywhere in Jesus, but Sarah and I hang out with them because we feel like God may spur something at some point. Mm-hmm. But I don't, even those relationships, I just enjoy the friendship for what it is. I don't go to dinner or go out and then like, I've got to move this person from A to B. I just don't. So a lot of, I think God has just kind of, as the more loved I have sensed from him and lived in, the freer I've been from the expectations of others and from the manipulation of what I need to do for other people to fulfill a ministry. I would say in the last 25, 30 years, I've only spent the bulk of my time with hungry people.
Mm.
And I'm in those conversations, and I'm as fired up coming out of that kind of an environment as I am going in. I don't come out exhausted. I might be physically exhausted, but man, it fuels me to watch God engage people and hear their stories and see what God's doing. And so, yeah, I haven't been near burnout in a long time. Mm. I can't remember the last time I felt like, oh my gosh, I just need to get away and whatever. My vacations don't feel really any different than my work days. And partly that's because, you know, I get to live in a framework where I don't have responsibility to a job. And I don't look at Livestream as responsibility to a job. In fact, Sarah and I haven't been paid this year. We took ourselves off salary because we had some investments that needed to be recouped. And so we're doing what we do for free. And that helps. That helps a ton.
Yeah.
Because I don't have to do anything. If it's not in my heart to do, I don't do it. But we were doing that before the financial freedom was there. I've never seen Livestream is I'm earning a salary from them, even when I was getting paid. It was, no, I'm doing what God's asked me to do in the world. Livestream's the vehicle. If they ever don't want to be the vehicle, then God will have other vehicles. So
I feel like that's, especially in, as we've been talking about this Mark Driscoll thing and that podcast that's been going on and just the conversations that I've been having with a lot of young adults, a lot of these people are very, very talented. But they're already in their late 20s, early 30s, and they're looking at, how do I prevent burnout? I feel like I'm already going there. What do I do to stop this? Like, how do I preserve my love for this, or how do I preserve my heart in this? It is a constant challenge. And I don't know if it's different in today's world, if the demands or the expectations are different on late 20, early 30 somethings, mid 30 somethings, I don't know. But like in that podcast that Christianity Today was doing, they were talking about a pile of dead bodies, and those were Gen Xers. Those were people even before my time that were crumbling in their 20s and 30s.
My observation, though, is that would always be true.
Yeah.
If you get caught in a vocation, particularly if it was something that you loved, and then you found that vocationally it beat the love out of you, that's what's really hard. I think that's harder than like a factory job where you just go there because it's your 8 hours a day, and you go in there and you do your job and you come home with income and then you enjoy your life outside of that. That's different. If it was your passion, like if you're a singer and a creator, songwriter, and you get involved with a record company that only wants to do their kind of song, that's why I left the publishing industry years ago, because they want to take the gift I have and just prostitute it, to use your word, as a yearly book. You just,
yeah,
you just write the same thing every year just to keep people reading the Wayne Jacobson He Loves Me stuff, because that's your best book. You got to keep writing that book. And I've had publishers send me proposals to do books for them, and it's He Loves Me, just in a different package, different name. But I, and I say, I've already written this book. Yeah, but you need to write this book every year because people will buy it. I'm going, yeah, that would make me a different person over time.
Yeah.
That's what I think. I think because it's already in the world, but people may not read it because it's old, but I catch people reading it every year. Just saying, I've just found your book. And I, you know, so I'm not worried about that. If I wrote another one, different content, different title, different cover, different whatever, but got to the same message, I would feel cheap because it's already there. And if there was a different way to say it that was important to say it, maybe. But I've just shied away from that. I got this yuck meter thing. And when it pegs a little bit, when I'm talking to somebody on the phone, I'm invited into so many projects. I can't tell you.
Yeah.
And my yuck meter goes off pretty fast. I know almost within 10 minutes if this is going to be a yes. I feel I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
The language of healing that Bob Prater called me. And even though I know that's a bad road to go down, you can't sell that book, you know, waste a year writing it, all the things that pragmatically in my head would say, yeah, don't do this. Within 5 minutes, I'm saying, whatever you want, man, I'm in. Mm-hmm. I think that needs to be in the world, even if people aren't listening to it. And interestingly enough, Bob this week had one of the big time prophet guys in the U.S. call him up and say, I just read your book. I think you prophetically speak to a world to get us out of this polarization. And I want to know more. And, you know, we get things like that, too, that don't pan out at times. But
yeah,
who knows? Who knows if there's a genuine thing? I wanted that in the world, even if it took 10 years for people to understand what we're saying or at least hear it. So, yeah, but the most things I'm within a few minutes of going, yeah, this is just about monetizing something. And I'm even more convinced than when I was young. I used to teach the you can't serve God and mammon passage.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's a great one to get people, you know, disconnected from money and feeling guilty and everything else you need to do to manipulate the tarnation out of them. But I have only really understood that in the last 20 years. Mm. How if I'm going to monetize something as my goal, that will shape the message if monetization is the goal. All you have to do is look at every app on your iPhone or whatever. It was I promise you, all of my apps were better the day they were created by some guy in a basement who had a great idea for an app. It didn't even cost anything generally starting out, yeah. and it worked flawlessly, right? And then some company buys them out for millions of dollars. Now there's advertising all over it. It doesn't work well. Even the Apple updates on the iPhone itself, the podcast app, for those of you listening by podcast, gets worse and worse with every release. It's more complicated. It won't play the next one that it's supposed to play. It starts playing from January 1st. I'm just going, who ruins these things? Who sits in an office somewhere in Cupertino, California and says, let's ruin a perfectly good app? But I think we've done that with lots of things. I think religion's done that. We've layered and layered and layered because we wanted to monetize it. And not a little bit. I don't mind people got a good song, got a good book, want to charge 10, 15 bucks for your book. I have no problem with that.
No.
But then when you want to maximally monetize something, you're going to make all bad choices. You want to put your best content behind a paywall and you're supposedly giving the kingdom of God away to the world and not trusting God to provide for you. So you want other people to pay to get your good stuff. I just go, I don't believe that what you're selling is the kingdom at the end of the day. There may be some spiritual truth in what you're saying, but man, you don't trust God enough to give in the world.
Well, especially when you're coming from the perspective that it's your best content.
Yes.
I feel like that's part of the thing is like people are just saying, the people who are genuinely wanting to put it out in the world, it's like, man, this is a gift that I feel like the Father has given me. He's helped me navigate this. And how do I get other people to have access to this? What does that even look like?
Yeah. The other part of that you were talking about is oversharing. I'm not sure those are connected. How does that prostitute your passion?
It's a prostitution instead of, so there's two different forms of prostitution. There's a prostitution for monetization, and so other people's gains. And then there's a prostitution of the things that are important to them for emotional capital, for emotional gain, for relational gain.
Okay.
And so they're saying that, hey, like I had this incredible experience, and I've got to get it all. And also it pushes into monetization because they're like, well, I want to be an influencer. I want to be an influencer on social media. Okay. And so I'm going to share all these things, these intimate things about my life in order to try to make connections so that I can build an audience so that I can just do that for my life. And yet I find like, here's a great example. I was fishing with a good friend of mine's son, took him out and was teaching him some new fishing techniques. And he catches this beautiful brook trout, 12 inches, gorgeous coloring, like amazing. And the first thing I go to do is grab for my phone. And it's like, no, this was a special moment for you and him. That's it. It's not going to be blasted on Facebook. It's not going to be on Instagram. It's not going to be on Snapchat. It's not going to be the screensaver for my phone tomorrow. It just was for us. And yet I meet so many people that find themselves just feeling exhausted because they're constantly putting out content from their heart, trying to gain emotional capital, relational capital, and yet they find themselves exhausted, that they have no reserves. There's nothing about them that nobody doesn't know, because they have to just put it out there with hopes that that love and that affirmation, that level of sharing will be reciprocated.
So what you're saying is you've got a yuck meter.
Yes.
I mean, anybody think, what? Nothing wrong with taking a picture of a trophy catch here in the middle of this thing and celebrate it and, you know, let them know I'm out with this guy and we're having this great day. There's nothing wrong with that, but there's a yuck thing that goes, I'm ruining something here that's beautiful.
Yes.
See, next time you do it, it may be just fine. You'll feel really good about
Absolutely.
Taking a snap and all that. But that's what I think. People who live freely and live wonderfully in the world have a yuck meter, and they've allowed God to sensitize it. So they realize when they're ruining a moment. And a lot of times you recognize you're ruining a moment because you've ruined those moments before. That's how I've learned a lot of this, right? You've done this, you've put something on Facebook or whatever, and you think, oh, this will be a big deal. And then it does nothing to it because all you did was provoke the jealousy of other people, and they just didn't come at you the same way that you would have hoped they would have, and it would have been viral and been a big deal. So I think your yuck meter gets set oftentimes if you're sensitive enough to admit mistakes and recognize, hey, I did this for that reason, but that's not the reason. That reason didn't eventuate, or that wasn't as fruitful as I hoped. But to me, it would all come down eventually to intention. Mm. When I share stuff, am I doing this for me so I look good? Then that's going to peg my yuck meter when I recognize that. And I may be slow to recognize that, but it will peg it. If I'm sharing this because I think it will help others who are dealing with the same thing in their heart and life, because to me, and I guess we're talking, when you were first talking about oversharing, I was thinking about individual conversations with people, and you're more talking about media stuff. Anything I'm doing that exploits your response to me is just, Jesus, peg my yuck meter, because that's not what sharing's about. If I need something from you, a gift is, this is for you. I'm sharing this, hopefully, to help you. Now, can I trick myself with that? Because who can't?
Yeah.
But overall, it's, why am I sharing this? And I remember having dinner one time with two couples. One was brand new, just met us, and we invited another couple to come along with us, and we were sitting there, and they were asking questions, and I was answering honestly like I do, because I don't think I help you if you're asking me honest questions and I'm giving you, you know, homogenized answers. I'm giving you, you know, things that make me look good. So I was sharing some stuff that was brutal, and this guy afterwards, my friend that came along with it, he said, why do you do that? I said, what? He said, you shared some pretty vulnerable stuff. You know, they could take that and really judge you with it. And I'm going, wow. I see. And that thought never crossed my mind, but I get what you're saying. If somebody wants to write a tell-all Wayne Jacobson, whatever, but you know, I have shared my bad stuff as much as I've shared my good stuff. I think, I think I've tried to be genuine enough to say, this is where I struggle. This is what God has done in me. I celebrate. But if I'm sharing anything to get emotional capital from someone, I'm already off the rails. It's just manipulation. That's all it is, which I know is our version of leadership, particularly Christian leadership, trying to get people to do what they otherwise wouldn't freely choose to do. And when all that focuses on you and I want their emotional response, I want their feel bad for me or pain for me, then it's not helpful.
And I think that's where the two come together, is with the idea or the word prostitution. You're trying to gain something. It's not a genuine gift. There's an ulterior motive or manipulation, or there's a capital, whatever it might be, that you're trying to fill yourself with or trying to obtain by sharing that, whatever it is. And man, just hear it, like, because I was listening to these conversations and I'm like, they're paralleling one another. Like, one is about money. The other one is about likes on Facebook or Instagram. And yet, they're both a form of capital. They're both sharing these things in order to fill a space or try to, you know, either fill a financial need or an emotional need or whatever, but it's not a gift that they're sharing with the world. And the idea of not sharing that gift is really interesting to me. Because, for example, one of these individuals had a really hard time with the idea of doing a trip and not taking their phone. Because, well, I have to document it. What if something amazing happens on the trip and I don't document it and I can't share it with other people?
Yeah.
Well, you have the memory. Like, you have a beautiful, powerful, intimate experience. It was just for you. It was a gift to you. Period. That's it. Does it have to have that documentation all the time?
I guess if you go back to, if we're doing that with our wife, every good thing that happens with my wife, I'm sharing with other people, so I look better in their eyes. I'm really abusing my wife, right?
Yeah.
Because I think what we're talking about more than prostituting our gift maybe is pimping out our gift. Because the prostitute's not the one usually who's being forced to do it, you know, whatever. They're not gaining a lot out of this. But we're taking something beautiful, wonderful, innocent, and we're using it for our own gain. And I what would most deal with that, I think, the more I live loved and know that Father's got me and my validation is in Him, then I'm not going to be using other people to get that validation. I'm not going to use other people to reinforce. I'm not going to get their sympathy because I already have God's empathy. God's already my, you know, faithful high priest. He understands everything I'm going through and He's with me in it. So I don't have to share. Now, I can share for help. I can share with brothers and sisters some deep stuff because I want their help and I have the relationship with them, which that's helpful, which to me is really different than I'm just manipulating people's emotions, which you've spoken on a stage enough, and I have too. You know what stories to tell that provoke the emotional response that seems so anointed of the Holy Spirit, but you're just manipulating the crowd because that's easy to do.
Yeah.
You don't have to be much of a speaker to know how to do that. And to make sure that we're embracing gifts, I love that God arranges things just for us. I love that. And I think most of the stuff in my life doesn't get shared publicly. But the stuff that does is because I feel like it will help somebody else.
Yeah.
And I've got a track record that say, that seems to work with people. I don't think I'm making people more dependent on Wayne or more emotionally connected to Wayne's success or whatever. I don't think that's not the email I get. where some people with influencers, whatever, they're vicariously living through that other person. I've really tried to avoid that. I don't know if I've done it well, but I've tried.
Well, I think the beauty of what I have seen you do and when you're having conversations both with myself or with other people is you have a deep well of life experience to draw from, of memories, of experiences, of moments. And so you can pull from that deep well, that deep reserve, and say, oh, you know, here, let me, this might be meaningful to you, or this might help you know how to navigate this situation. And yet so often I meet so many people that they've got a handful of stories that they regurgitate over and over and over again because they're not actually living in their life. Or maybe they were previously, but now they just have those old stories that they point back to instead of that continuous inflow that's just constantly filling up those reserves of life experience and an intimate experience of being loved. And then you can draw from those as you need to help people in their process and in their journey.
Yeah, I think there's a real gift of being able, when you're in a conversation with somebody, whether it's 25 people in a room or just me one-on-one with somebody, there's a gift that recognizes how the person you're talking to is getting this. Mm. And I mean, one of the things I've never wanted to do is bore anyone. I don't share a long story with them. I usually share a little bit of a story, kind of, you know, and if they ask more, we'll go deeper. Because I don't ever want somebody to be bored. Like I've got their, you know, captive audience thing, and I'm going to use them. Even when I was a preacher at a pulpit, I was like, I really don't want anyone in this room to be bored. So I want to find things that I can look and see in a conversation, especially when their eyes are kind of glazed over. And as soon as you finish sharing what you shared, they change the subject. You kind of know from that they weren't into what you were saying.
Yep.
Now, most people I'm with, sometimes they'll go back and try to say, well, you missed what I was saying. Let me try to do this again. You're going, okay, listen, they're bored. They really weren't connecting with that story. Move on. But some people don't have that gene, whatever it is, that goes, I am aware of how much this is connecting, or if it's not, and maybe that's a gift of the Spirit to realize somebody's connecting with this, or no, you're just blowing wind, blowing in the wind. It's not going anywhere.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.